Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. For more information about subscribing to the show, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. If you're a fan of the show and you want to help support it, then please consider becoming a patron of the show through our page on the website Patreon. By pledging as little as a dollar an episode, you can get access to some great benefits, such as a private discussion forum, early access to new episodes, higher quality recordings, and more. Today is Friday, August 14th, 2015, at approximately 11:22 a.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 42nd episode of the show. In this episode, I'll be interviewing astrologer Mark Jones about his new book titled The Soul Speaks, The Therapeutic Potential of Astrology. To order the book or find out more information about Mark, please visit his website at plutoschool.com. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
All right. I've been wanting to do this episode for a while now, ever since we talked earlier this year. And you mentioned that you're writing the book, and I've been looking forward to it, and then finally got a copy and got a chance to read it. And I was really impressed and excited, because I think this is something what you wrote essentially was you tried to write a book about what psychology has to give to astrology in some sense. And you included a lot of really good information that I think is practical and really useful for practicing astrologers, but that they might not know if they don't have your sort of background in psychology and counseling. So maybe a good starting point would be, what is your background and what sort of training do you have that made it useful for writing this book, or maybe what motivated you to write it first?
So when I was in my 20s, around the nodal opposition at 27, just prior to the Saturn return, my father died. I was in a band. I was studying astrology intensely. I'd been studying Kabbalah with Warren Kenton, or Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, as he was called in his Sephardic name. And that's where I encountered astrology. And at this point, my astrology reading had taken me deeply into the work of Liz Green, Howard Sasportas, Stephen Arayo, the real, you know, modern epitome of modern psychological astrology. And my father died, and talking with a friend, we saw this really interesting guy, our first therapist, ostensibly. And he recommended us for this training that was operating and is the reason why I live in Bristol now. So very, very young, essentially babies on the course. We were 27 years old when we were accepted on a psychotherapy training in psychosynthesis. That, you know, we broke the age requirement, really. I think they let us on because we'd had experience in the Findhorn community in Scotland, like a spiritual community. We'd had some experience of group work. But I'd only had a therapist for a few months, and there was people on this training who were already therapists or who had had years of therapy. So I was thrown into the deep end of group work, you know, process work. I remember the absurd feeling when the very first group work day, this lady who'd been in therapy for years just took the stone in the center of the room, the speaking stone kind of thing, and just screamed at the top of her lungs. You know, I've always wanted to do that in a therapy group. I'm 27 years old. I'm just stood there, sat there thinking, WTF, you know, what have I just signed up for? And then they proceeded to have an argument for 20 minutes about whether we should have the window open in the room. And I thought, I've come on the wrong thing. And then a few years into it, I just noticed this incredible transformation in me as I began to shift beyond my primarily conceptual or mental identity of myself into some form of experiential process. I mean, it really did get me on that level. And yet, I say all of that, and the training was only something. It was something, it was a powerful something, but it was really my supervision group when I started working as a therapist about 4 years later, and my personal therapeutic journey with two spiritually orientated therapists. And these started to come together then in the first years of practicing. And I'd put astrology on the back burner. In fact, at some points during this training, I'd had to explain astrology to my course director. You know, here we are as therapists with this ideal that the client will reveal something to us of their emergent self, and we will help them facilitate that emergence. And here you are with this astrology thing, and you're going to tell people about themselves. You know, how does that fit with our with our view. And I took these things really seriously. I mean, I spent years contemplating that basic divide. Now, this all emerges out of years of therapy work. And then, as my astrological work, which didn't totally disappear, so it started to come back into my life, and I started to express it more and teach schools in the UK, and then got invited to North America, and the real generosity of Canadians and Americans in being open to my work and inviting me to present in all these different places, I began to notice the way that my astrology work informed my psychotherapeutic practice. But I crucially began to notice that years of being a therapist was completely changing the way I did readings, completely changing the way I talked to people, and the kind of insight I had to offer. And I thought, it wasn't really a thought. It was more like you're swimming along in a stream and you notice how two streams come together. You know, the river just sort of deepens, widens. It was like, wow, I am being carried along in some immense river.
Right. And one of the statements, just to interrupt really quickly, you make it towards the beginning of the book, as you say, you make a few really interesting sort of quasi-provocative statements that I thought were worth probably highlighting here. The first was that you sort of made this point that you said in particular, you said that you said psychotherapy has an advantage of over astrology. To the extent that psychotherapists have spent more time contemplating the complex dynamics of the apparent obvious reality of the two people in the room. And you go on and make other sort of similar statements towards the beginning of the book as you're sort of setting up the premise of what this book is for and why you're writing it, saying that, for example, that the understanding of the relationship between the astrologer and the client in your perspective still lacks a consistent focus in the astrological mainstream. So despite the sort of almost revival or not revival, but the emergence of psychological astrology in the late 20th century, that you still felt like there was something missing.
Yes.
In terms of that in the astrological community. And what was that exactly?
I feel that psychological astrology, and this was something I wanted to avoid very explicitly in The Soul Speaks, has become a method. It has become a methodological statement or process. It's become a form of astrology amongst other forms of astrology. I wanted to make the point in this book that the relationship between an astrologer and client was a counseling relationship, no matter what form of astrology. You could be a specialist in astrolocation, astrocartography, mapping, and it would still be a counseling-like relationship. If your client comes to you and says, I'm unhappy where I'm living, I'm thinking of moving to the West Coast, or I'm thinking of moving to Canada, can you help me with the astrolocation? And you're going to discuss, you know, her Venus line or her Sun-Jupiter line or whatever, in local space or whatever. You're in a counseling relationship because she's unhappy where she is, because she's come to you for advice, because she is a supplicant other seeking your professional guidance and wisdom. There is the edges of a counseling relationship, not a committed one. She's not signing up for psychotherapy with you. She won't be there 3 years later crying about, you know, early childhood loss. But it is in and of itself a counseling relationship. It has constellated one temporarily, simply by dint of the supplicant individual coming to the authority or the authoritative figure. And I wanted to address that. I wanted to show that the kind of counseling dynamics I'm talking about are just intrinsic to human relationship. It's not about a method. It's not about trying to persuade people to read charts psychologically or, you know, accept Liz Green's statement that Saturn in the fourth refers to the mother or fourth house, the father, sorry, rather than the mother, or, you know, whatever it is, or moon-sun dynamics representing the nature of the kind of mother you had with the moon or the father with the sun or whatever methods psychological astrology have to approach early childhood experience. It's not about that. It's just about what actually occurs between two people in a room. And that's where psychotherapy has had this edge, because it's studied projective and transferential dynamics between two people. It has studied the way that we repeat early childhood experience when we form significant relationships.
Right. So just essentially that when you put two people in the room, that you create a sort of dynamic between them, especially when they're in the sort of like counselor patient or whatever you want to call it, client counselor sort of relationship, that certain dynamics emerge, and that because that's virtually all that psychologists focus on, and that's what they do day in, day out, that they've developed different methods of identifying different dynamics that emerge during that and how to deal with them, and that that's something practical and valuable for astrologers no matter what your approach is.
Exactly that. Simple, radical to some, bleeding obvious to some others. If you approach astrology non-prejudicially, if you don't have some huge agenda about the kind of figure you are by being an astrologer, you see that's just obvious. That, you see, there's a series of dynamics going on. You know, you yourself have techniques that might expose patterns in people's lives. The zodiacal time lord or releasing techniques or whatever. You have them in your mind, it's clear. In your mind, or it's clear and you're evolving it into new directions as you progress in your development, in your maturation, in your career. How do you translate that to an individual? There is a communication issue instantly, isn't there? Some individuals might know astrology backwards and you can just talk to them on the level of a professional collegiate relationship. But others won't know a thing about it. What is it to communicate? As soon as you look to that other that's come to you with questions, you're into a communication issue. You're into a relational dynamic, even a heart-centered dynamic. You know, do you care about this other person in front of you? I've heard famous astrologers, not joking, say things like, oh my God, I can't believe that last reading I did. That client was just winding me up. My goodness, they pissed me off. I heard another colleague, you know, why, what was up? Oh, they just wouldn't shut up. The client just wouldn't stop talking. I couldn't present my astrological vision or wisdom to them in an uninterrupted style. While to me, this is just painful listening. From a therapist's point of view, you want that emergent space to hold the emergent being. You want the person to come and share. Because it's a sign of trust. It's a sign of engagement. And then you wait patiently and listen and come in at the appropriate time with, you know, the questions they've come to you for or the reception they're looking for. And the other realization is that some of these people may appear to have questions, but actually they want a trusted figure. They're projecting authority. They're projecting meaning onto you. And this happens even in conferences. You don't even have to be having a reading with an astrologer to constellate that kind of transference. You could be sat at the back of a lecture hall and just think this person is the answer, you know. And I think these are very dynamics we have to be very careful of. It's not that that's wrong. And to an extent, an individual that's traveled to a conference or traveled for a reading with the great Chris Brennan, say, may have validity in thinking that. Maybe Chris Brennan really will help them. But there's a danger in that feeling being unexamined, that they project their personal power and authority and give it away in a way that's detrimental to the next steps in their life.
Right. You addressed this a little bit in talking about a section discussing like what sort of perceptions a client or patient, or what's the correct term? What term do you use, client?
I use client. An analyst, a psychoanalyst or a Jungian analyst might use patient, but I use client. I don't like the medical model.
Sure. So a client, like what sort of perceptions a client is going to approach the astrologer with, and there being different models of that, or like three, I think at least you identified different typical sort of things, not baggage, like baggage maybe isn't the correct term, but sort of perceived preconceptions that a client will approach having a consultation either with a psychologist or an astrologer with, and to be sort of aware of those, because that can color the client's perception of what they're trying to get out of the consultation and who you are as a counselor, I guess.
And it can impact the astrologer themselves, you see. This is the other hook. I mean, I think it's essential for deep work with people to understand their projection dynamics and the tendency of anyone in a significant relationship, including one's personal relationships, to project one's unresolved childhood material. I mean, just everyone does that somewhere. But the hook here is also the dangers to the profession. I mean, therapists, at least ideally, and this does not always work ideally, let's be frank, they are supervised rigorously, especially in the early days of practicing. And by that, I mean they are rigorously cross-examined at points. What do you think was going on here? How do you think you reacted? And they're analyzed for, like, you know, are you inflated at this point? Are you deflated? You know, do you feel terrible about yourself? You'll never be any good at it. Or do you think you're the best thing since sliced bread and you're just going to help millions of people without any problem? And what one realizes when one identifies dynamics like that, positive projections are as dangerous to the professional as negative projections. There would be many astrologers that could come and talk to you and go, I had this horrible reading. The person misunderstood what I said. They didn't like it. You know, I had a difficult time. They didn't seem happy. It made me feel not very good about myself. I want to talk about it. That's easy to understand, yeah? To analyze, how can I improve on that in the future? Was it just that the other person had an issue and didn't like me or freaked out, whatever? But what people don't realize is positive projections. You know, you're just brilliant. Thank you so much. You're the best thing ever. That's just as dangerous to professional equilibrium and integrity, because it tends to elicit unconscious responses in the astrologer, wanting to help people more, wanting to reach that extra mile, to have that pleasurable feeling of being the helper. And these are dangerous, potentially dangerous dynamics. They can lead people to saying things that they didn't really mean, to overreaching, or to simply just enjoying a projected energy and basking in it, and which might fail the client, the person that traveled all that way to see you. Because what I pick up is, in a world that's very fragmented about its sense of higher meaning, astrology, that's seen as a joke by so many people, actually becomes much more important to some other people. In a world where there is no overt expression of a higher purpose or meaning anymore, really. We're not really per se a Christian culture anymore, America slightly more than the UK, and that science hasn't really come up with a philosophy that's as complete as its technological vision. We lack this sense of why we're here and what we're doing, and people come to astrologers with that. They come with it right up inside themselves. Why am I here and what am I doing? I mean, just feel the projected meaning in that right from the beginning. It's something that, I'm not judging it, it's not even wrong to feel that way at all, but it's just, how are we going to handle that? And how can we handle it in a way that gives the most power and integrity and sense of choice back to that client, rather than holding on to it?
And that actually brings us back to a point that I led us on a long digression from, which is your specific approach in the psychological school that you're coming from has sort of a explicitly spiritual slant to it. And Yes. That's part of your background with psychosynthesis. Maybe you could explain a little bit and define, because in the book several times, both on the cover and on the inside, you define yourself or refer to yourself as a psychosynthesis therapist.
Yeah.
So maybe you could define what psychosynthesis is.
So in the early part of the 20th century, a young Italian doctor-to-be, a polymath, you know, as a teenager, he speaks seven languages, travels to Russia on his own, reads Freud in the original, the interpretation of dreams when it comes out, in the original German, writes to the Freud as a teenager and has a student correspondence with him, and becomes in Freud's eyes the potential harbinger of psychoanalysis in Italy, a young doctor, Roberto Assagioli. And then Assagioli spends time at the Bacolzi Clinic in Switzerland, and he's a contemporary of Jung's at that point. They're studying together under Eugene Bleuler, who is the man who really puts together Freud's theory as an actual working practice. A man who, incidentally, doesn't buy into Freud, writes to Freud explicitly saying, I appreciate your work like I appreciate the work of a great literary master, but I don't consider it just, you know, universal truth. Really frustrated Freud. But Bleuler's this incredibly creative, dynamic man working with very damaged people. And Jung and Assagioli are right there in the creative ferment of this new form, this new emergent form. The two people that will take it on further than Freud. The two people that will bring this explicitly psyche-led, soul-led in Jung's case, and explicitly spiritual dimension in Assagioli's case, because he has a series of kind of awakening, or I suspect an intuitive near-death experience in early childhood, which sort of show him a certain vision of possibility, of meaning. So he's studying all these great spiritual figures and all these great artists and philosophers from the past at the same time as he's studying psychoanalysis. And right from a young age, he's writing, psychoanalysis is only interested in the basement of the building. I am interested in the whole building of the human, the whole, all the stories of the building. He's aware, even as he studies with Freud, that Freud is only interested in the subconscious drives and mechanisms and hidden dynamics lurking under the surface. And Sagioli is aware that we also have like this visionary element, that we repress this potential for power and creativity and beauty and joy. And he sees that from a very young age. So I trained in psychosynthesis.
So eventually Sagioli goes on to found the school of psychosynthesis. Exactly. As a specific school of psychology.
Yes. And it's initially at the early Uranus conferences that get taken over by Jung later on, as Jung is less impressed at this point with the Sagioli because of the Sagioli's links to theosophy. But by this point, Sagioli has already shown himself to be a very inspirational teacher. And there are institutes popping up all over the world, especially just after the Second World War. What happens, though, is you have this fantastic meeting prior to the Second World War, and then this tragedy, in a way. Jung and Sagioli have been contemporaries and still have correspondence, although we don't have some of it, which is very sad. And then Dana Rudyard is studying Jung. And right at the heart of a certain aspect of the modern psychological, modern spiritual astrological movement and the roots of evolutionary astrology, as you and I have discussed previous, and in fact you even pointed me to certain specific sections of astrology of personality. And this is the period that Rudyard's in. He's writing Astrology of Personality in 1936. He's been studying Jung, and he visits Europe and meets with the Sagioli, and they discuss charts together, they study charts together, they discuss the vision of spirituality, they discuss the vision of astrology and the emergent psychological paradigm and what role it could have within a spiritual compass. This is all in 1936. And then, of course, Mussolini takes over in Italy. The Psychosynthesis Institute is demonized as a pacifist organization and therefore anti-Mussolini's intentions. And Sagioli is imprisoned in solitary confinement for a month, and then is on the run, and his family home is sacked and destroyed, his papers destroyed, his possessions destroyed, the house that he'd hung out with Dana Rudyard destroyed, and he lives wild with, you know, British paratroopers that are behind enemy lines and members of the Italian resistance, during which time his only son contracts tuberculosis of the bone through the exposure, which he will die of a few years after the war. So the cost is tremendous. And during this time, Sagioli holds on to a private vision of a spiritual psychology, which then after the war begins to just flower in the world. And it was massive in Italy. It's still big today in parts of America, parts of Scandinavia, Holland, the UK, Italy. Although it became a different thing in Italy, a slightly more academic thing. Psychosynthesis is still a living force in the world, although admittedly a somewhat esoteric one. But this is partly because of the destruction of Sagioli's papers during the war and his own decision to destroy some of them later on for whatever reason. I suspect because of his theosophical and spiritual interests, which he felt the world was not ready for.
Okay, so psychosynthesis is essentially then an attempt to integrate depth psychology with sort of a spiritual or metaphysical approach.
Yes.
And an acceptance of metaphysical things. And it's fascinating to me from a historical perspective because, as you said, Sagioli is a contemporary, essentially, of both Jung and Freud. And even though astrologers tend to focus more on Jung, and he tends to be the primary like psychological model that astrologers have gone back to ever since Rudyard. As you've pointed out, Sagioli had interactions with Rudyard, and so there's the potential that Sagioli was also influencing Rudyard at that point.
Yes.
During that formative period where he's writing some of his earliest works, such as the Astrology of Personality.
Yes, and Rudyard's influencing them. And astrology itself is influencing them. And the two great figures that will expand Freud's work into psychic or spiritual or soul-centered territory, Carl Jung and Roberto Sagioli, both allow astrology to dominate their learning for huge periods of time. Both are practicing astrologers. In the second half of Asagioli's life, he wouldn't work with clients without their chart. And all of this I uncover in an archive in Florence a few years ago when a friend and colleague spoke for a psychosynthesis conference in Rome. And we were invited into the archive, and we're being led up into the archive in Asagioli's old house. And the lady says, "This is the main room, but there's a side room here." And she almost looks at me and my friend and colleague. "And there's a side room which we'll let you in if you really want to." And she points to it. And we look through this open door, and there are three boxes lined across the wall that just say "Spiritual Astrology in English" on them. And there's just boxes of his astrological hand-drawn charts, handwritten notes, printouts, theosophical Alice Bailey-influenced musings on full moon meditations, just masses of material. Must have taken hundreds of hours just drawing up all these charts. And one realizes that Carl Jung and Roberto Asagioli were not just students of astrology, they were dynamic, practicing astrologers. And isn't it interesting? You know, a book that I started out to write about what psychotherapy in particular could offer astrology in terms of communicating with clients and the relationship dynamic and putting across the sense of service and meaning within it. Also came this realization that astrology itself had supported these pioneering figures go beyond Freud into deeper meaning, that it was a crucial part of the way they saw the world, and that it helped them, as like an invisible architecture or scaffolding, develop this new, larger vision of the psyche that transcended Freud's limitations. And that just fascinated me, this crucial cross-fertilization period in the mid-1930s, just prior to the Second World War, that then gets blown apart by the Second World War. And all these people are on sort of opposing sides. You know, Freud's forced to escape as a Jew in Vienna, and Jung takes over the Psychoanalytical Society in Germany, and they're all just disparate. And Asagioli is literally on the run for his life. I mean, would have been sent to a camp. It's just remarkable, really, and tragic to some extent that this incredible coming together was ripped apart like that. But this
So you're, in the process of writing this book, which you've been working on at least since, I think, 2011, right?
I started with the ideas then. The writing began in earnest in the latter part of 2012, early 2013.
Okay. So initially the book was supposed to be, you know, what we can take from psychology and counseling as a practicing psychologist and therapist, and what astrologers need to know in order to help them, deal with some of the dynamics that come up in consultations. But in the process, you discover that your primary source and the founder of your psychological school himself was a practicing astrologer, and that informed in some ways the development of his system of psychology.
Exactly. I mean, can you believe it? After all those conversations on my training and these contemplations, to discover that the man himself was on the same path. I mean, the book is still this attempt to take psychotherapeutic material and show astrologers how effective that could be in the setting of the natal chart reading or any follow-up work around it. But yes, it became this bigger realization that at the heart of the 20th century, just prior to the Second World War, just prior to the Holocaust, the atomic revolution, there is this coincident with the discovery of Pluto, basically, in the era shaped by the discovery of Pluto, you have this incredible meeting of these figures who personally interact with each other, the founders of depth psychology, and the core figure, in my view, Dana Rudyard, is the core figure of the foundation of modern psychological and especially modern spiritual astrology via evolutionary astrology, who I think one can correctly see Dana Rudyard as the father of, really.
Definitely, sure. So that was sort of their contribution and an interesting sort of personal discovery. But really the point of this book is to expose astrologers to and sort of teach them some useful tools from psychology that can be used in the context of counseling. And one of the things, maybe we should touch on some of the things that you do try to present or address. One of the things that was interesting is an extensive chapter dealing with different types of defense systems that people have when they come into a consultation that astrologers need to be aware of and sort of know how to identify and deal with. Maybe we should talk about a few of those. What are some of the core sort of defense systems that people have when they come in to see counselors?
So I present this a whole chapter in that. I've also produced a condensed article in the Mountain Astrologer on the same themes. And this is the core territory that will develop the Counseling Skills for Astrologers program that I'm developing in the aftermath of the book, a detailed 12-part examination of how to deal with these dynamics, of how we see the subject, of how we see the person in front of us. Because what people tend to do is basically project unresolved parts of their identity into any situation or any relationship of any significance. And that is a universal theme. That doesn't just happen in astrological consultations or psychotherapeutic consultations. You are doing that, you know, with your girlfriend this weekend. You are doing that with a friend. You are doing that with a teacher from school, your parent, whatever. We just do that. That's what human beings do when we feel unresolved about something or it's destabilized within ourselves, particularly if that instability relates back to early childhood material. And what we see at the core of depth psychology become these insights from people like Heinz Kohut, in particular, Kernberg, these kind of greats of the European psychoanalytical tradition, that they argue that there are these completely legitimate developmental needs. That at certain points, for example, the child must idealize the parent. It's crucial to their own self-development and aspirational energy that they idealize the parent. It's crucial that they find in the parent's mirroring gaze, the way the parent looks at them, a special uniqueness. You know, welcome to the world, Chris Brennan. We're so glad you're here. A special uniqueness from the parent so you feel valuable, sufficiently valuable. So we see that anyone who had any kind of break in this, anyone who had a dysfunctional family or was taken away from home through illness or a parent's struggle with mental or physical illness or working away or just parents that had lost their way as people and failed to individuate in some way and be able to offer these stable, steady, you know, sources of light and compassion for their children are deficient in these core developmental needs. And by saying their core developmental needs, what these people were saying was they'll always be core developmental needs until they are kind of met or until you see through them. So we unconsciously create situations as adults where the deficiencies of childhood experience are reenacted in order to see what's going on. And this is happening all the time. And it happens in astrological consultations. People, for example, to cover deep, deep anxiety about not receiving the mirror transference, you know, the sense of being valued as a unique self, may constantly pretend that they're okay. You know, that I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. And that we all know, don't we, that there's people who say I'm fine and it could mean all sorts. I've got clients that say I'm fine and they could mean I want to kill myself. I feel so bad. But they say I'm fine. It's just a defense against the deeper anxieties. Whole astrology readings, I'm convinced of this, are conducted with a client in a stance like that, that we could call an adaptive stance, a survival adaptation. Or, using the terms of Winnicott, the British psychologist and man who based his work on thousands of hours sort of playing with children and the observations of their experience, what he called the false self. So if those early deficiencies are severe enough and we don't believe somewhere within that they can be met, we start to develop this false or adaptive self that pretends everything is okay whilst compartmentalizing that some key part of what we really needed is put away somewhere in the back of our psyche because it's too vulnerable. It would bleed too much if people saw it. And it, you know, whole consultations can go on where the astrologer is like a magician, showing the fireworks of the chart and the amazing possibilities. And the client is just there as a false or adaptive self, nodding, yes, concealing their anxiety, concealing their real needs, concealing their real questions, concealing the real hurt in their lives, because that's what they do. And unless they're helped, unless the environment is facilitative of a different way of doing it, they won't stop. Because that's really what people are like, isn't it? The default setting of people is they don't change unless something happens in order for them to do so. And so it's these kinds of dynamics. Can we see into a deeper, more authentic experience of our client's being and therefore use the chart and what it represents symbolically about their life to help facilitate the emergent authentic being within them, the emergent real self. So I come from a psychotherapeutic tradition that posits that there is a real self. Freud struggled with this, but certain analytical thinkers like Winnicott and Karen Horney in America, even though they were followers of Freud, they saw that there was a real self, an authentic being. And I come from that tradition. You know, how can we see through defense only and honor defense? Because people have defenses for a reason. People have defenses because, you know, they were in a family where they stood out, they got slapped or shouted at or persecuted. You see, the healthy child will always want to share. The healthy child will come in and show you their painting from school or sing their little song, and they're not frightened of being judged. The child from a less healthy family may hide everything, because to be found out, you might be abused. To be found out, you might be molested or shouted at, persecuted or beaten. And people hide for all sorts of reasons, very legitimate reasons. You see, those reasons may have been absolutely essential to their survival when they're 3 years old or 5 years old. The problem is, when they're 35 years old or 53 years old, those very things that saved them at the time are ruining their life, draining all their psychic energy, making them see every situation with this kind of hypervigilance. Am I going to be safe in this situation? Are people going to, you know, react to me in a destructive and blame-orientated way like they did back then? And this is all happening subconsciously, draining them. And it's like, can astrology, this incredible symbolic map, be pressed in terms of serving the emergent need of the client's real being? Not because of its method, not because I'm an evolutionary astrologer, or you're a traditional Hellenistic astrologer, or somebody else is a modern psychological astrologer, or a Jyotish, or whatever, but because we simply compassionately care about the space, including the reality of the client's life, that room is being made for them to be real, even if it's challenging or difficult. So it's as much a therapeutic attitude as it is a methodological issue.
Sure. Yeah, I think you had a whole section talking about making sure that the discussion and things that are recommended especially match the client's life, and that the counselor is very clear about what's appropriate and what's attainable, rather than setting some sort of goal that's not attainable or not realistic within the context of the person's life.
I mean, it's such a brilliant thing to take from the book. I mean, I appreciate the quality of your reading there. I mean, imagine someone comes to you and you do the zodiac time-releasing thing.
The zodiacal whatever,
yes,
technique.
That's
right?
The one. That
we referred to earlier.
Yeah, the Doctor Who technique. And
right. That's good, the Time Lord techniques. Yeah. I like that. That's how you remember them.
Yeah. And, you know, you're giving them this amazing thing that could happen. You know, it's a full releasing of, you know, loosening of the belt buckle, you know. And then you present it, you know, you get carried away. You're so excited on their behalf. You might do this. You might write that book. You might journey to this place you were talking about. And they were just sharing with you a kind of dream fantasy that a lot of the time they feel disempowered about. Mm-hmm. If they don't have room in that session to share the disempowered bit, they might actually become inwardly crushed, even as you're selling them the inspirational message.
Right.
They might fall away from it inside, because that's what happens in their life. They have these dreams, they have these compensatory idealisms to compensate for inner shame and anxiety that their life might not amount to that. And it's like, can we become big enough as people, as practitioners that are service orientated? So I've even proposed sort of radical ideas, you know, could we even call some astrologers research astrologers and others counseling orientated astrologers? Because,
well,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, I remember this came up in our discussion earlier this year on modern versus traditional views on difficult chart placements, because that was actually a point of contention in terms of whether or not benefic and malefic are,
yes,
distinctions that should be used, or legitimate technical distinctions, versus whether they're legitimate technical distinctions but maybe shouldn't be used in consultations, at least in that terminology. And that was, I mean, it was interesting reading your take on needing to be realistic with the client about what their situation was, because that was my original counterpoint about why benefic and malefic is still a valid concept.
Yeah.
Because one of the issues I've sort of encountered with modern astrology occasionally is just that if in the desire to be empowering, there's this often overwhelming sense of like optimism that sometimes is way too optimistic and is lacking in realism about the actual circumstances in a client's life. And I think if you go too far with that, sometimes that can actually backfire and become disempowering.
Brilliant.
So I was happy to see you sort of addressing that in this book.
Yeah, very good. I mean, you and I are on the same page there, even if we have a different view of those terms. I mean, there's so many things we could say here. Being realistic about what's possible for a client is actually really empowering for them, just as it is to acknowledge the tremendous suffering in their life. To be excessively optimistic when a client is presenting information about terrible suffering or abuse or serious issues in their life, like a disability or something, is just simply insensitive, nonsense. It tends to be the practitioner's discomfort at facing the sheer level of suffering in the world and the particular suffering of the individual before them that makes them feel secretly and subconsciously disempowered and like there should be something in their magical toolkit as an astrologer to do something about it. Well, you know, I just don't hold with that at all. I liked what you said in that last conversation about, you know, malefic and benefic being technical terms and could we find a different way of presenting them to clients. It's just that there will be some clients. It'll be hard for some people to understand this, but there will be some clients who've had childhood abuse who simply will not hear malefic in anything other than an I'm wrong, I'm shameful kind of way.
Sure,
I call it the shame chart. Clients that can't even bear you to look at their chart because they're so ashamed. They think it will be a window into their soul and that window will show that they're terrible people. And it's almost always a consequence of significant childhood abuse or persecutory anxiety that has come around through tyrannical bullying or persecution. And it's an awful thing and it's very damaging to people, but there are more people than you think suffering with that very actively. And it really pays to pay attention to that because if they're heavily defended people, they won't let you know that you've made them feel that way. They will just suffer silently and walk away feeling more terrible.
Sure. Yeah. And actually, I mean, I'm not even sure this is a debate I'm having with myself as I'm developing and continuing to apply traditional and predictive astrology in consultations, you know, for a longer and longer period and getting more experience with it. The necessity of actually telling a client everything is actually, I would actually backtrack on that a little bit and say there's actually some instances where it's not necessary to be perfectly blunt or honest or whatever with a client, but instead you sort of have to judge their level of not consciousness, because I really sometimes have a problem when it's framed in that way, but just what the client is able to deal with and hear at that time.
Exactly.
And sort of internalize in a positive way versus what they're not. And an astrologer really does have to be very careful about, you know, not going into and perhaps not revealing everything, because perhaps they're able to see things about a person's life that person might not be able to handle at that particular point in time.
I mean, we're talking about the concept of readiness, really, aren't we, rather than consciousness, what they're ready for in their emergent life potential. And I think this is a very mature point. Why feel the need to say these things, or indeed anything beyond what the client asks for, sometimes in some situations when it's delicate? Less is more. You learn this as a therapist, the value of silence, the value of just silently holding in an accepting, compassionate gaze the experience the client's going through without trying to rescue it, without trying to brush it under the carpet. And that's just a receptive stance. I would encourage astrologers to experiment with the little moments of silence or receptiveness within a reading, that it doesn't have to be a performance dynamic where you're pressured to somehow show how great you are that justifies, you know, the fee or, you know, your reputation or something, and that you have to come up with these deep hidden truths about the person that because of your genius. To me, these are all narcissistic reflections of our own unmet vanities and needs as professionals. We should be focused at times on just what this person needs. And even if we can see things, is it true? Well, it might be, maybe. But then is it kind? Is it useful to this person at this point?
Right,
what's
right.
Kind and useful? What is a healing fiction? Because even if we're good, even if we're brilliant and we see something, that doesn't always work out like that. Life is way more mysterious than even the best predictive astrologer or the world's greatest psychic could ever predict. So, to honor where they are and use the gift, the few gifts we do have, to help them frame the next steps of their life. And then if they want more, they could always come back, couldn't they? And I'm working on models in the Counseling Skills for Astrologers course of follow-up readings, not long-term counseling, but just some readings are so intense for clients. I mean, it just hits people so intensely. And I'm not just talking like, you know, the meaning of my soul purpose type readings. It could just be, you know, the periods of potential success in their life, or even if your astrolocation line has this brilliant line going over the city you've never thought of before, that might spin a person out for the next few weeks. The concept of follow-up that I'm trying to work on is, for some astrologers, and this won't be all, but for some who are interested in exploring more consciously this counseling-orientated approach, there would be the capacity to offer up follow-up work, not developing a long-term therapeutic relationship, but something to facilitate the transformative meanings and ideas that came up within the reading itself. Because many readings, even if they're great ones, spin clients out. You know, they go into a little tailspin in their life. even if it was good stuff, you know, they're like freaked out because it kind of blew their mind or whatever.
Because it's such a shake-up or such a transformative experience.
Exactly.
That you sort of walk into a person's life, shake everything up, and then walk away if you've just done one consultation with them without any real follow-up or sort of guidance to help, you know, tell them where to go or whatever after that point.
Exactly. And that's why, to go back to your original point about realistic next steps, it's worth spending a few minutes in a reading at times just checking out a client's level of support in their life. You know, where are they at? Are you telling this, are you having this incredibly intense deep conversation with someone who has, you know, a loving family and loads of friends around them? Or are you talking to a person that's basically been on their own in a flat for the last, or an apartment for the last 18 months, barely seeing anyone, really quite depressed, you know? These are factors just worthy of note, not because you're going to become their therapist and sort it all out, just for how you offer what you're offering to them in the most sensitive way.
Sure. And part of that brings us back to the title of the book. What is the question that the book posits sort of implicitly, which is, what is the therapeutic potential of astrology? And the answer to that, which you answer pretty quickly, is that usually therapists have to spend a lot of time and a lot of follow-up sessions getting to know a person. But what you argue is that the birth chart offers a tool that really allows you to speed up and enhance the process of getting to know a person, and thus subsequently being able to address some of their either psychological issues or just life issues in general. And that's the therapeutic potential of astrology in some ways.
Yes, very good. Absolutely. Okay. I mean, the title, The Soul Speaks, is a literal translation of the word psychology. Psyche, soul, from the Greek word for butterfly. Logos, word, account, speech.
Right.
So literally, psyche, soul, logos, speaks. It's just translation, literal translation of the word psychology. And that's a very good point. I mean, I am a psychotherapist, so I can't deny that. The book really does, I think, raise ways of being therapeutic that you don't have to be a psychotherapist to work with. But I am one. And a lady I was doing a reading for the other day, who'd had years of high-quality therapy, was just so pleased with me. She was sort of bouncing for joy on Skype. And she exclaimed, "Wow, you're a psychotherapist with a roadmap." And it's like, after all these years of therapy, the feeling that she'd been with this quality psychotherapist without a roadmap, the difference was just startling to her.
Right. Because, I mean, it thinks of an analogy to me would be like, you're in a dark room and there's like an elephant or something, and you're trying to figure out what you're in this dark room with, and all you can do is sort of touch it with your hands and sort of feel the outlines of it until eventually you realize what it is. But and that's sort of where a therapist is in some sense, walking into a consultation with a client for the first time. Whereas if you're an astrologer and you have their birth chart with a birth time on it, let's say, then you basically walk into that room and then you flip on the light.
And yeah, it can literally be like that. I mean, what I've found is there's a hidden dimension being in a therapist, if you're a particular type of therapist, that one's inner intuition begins to turn on after years of doing it. And I've, you know, I'm around 10,000 hours of one-to-one work clinically with people, and something has turned on with me that can turn the light on sometimes, or a different light without the chart. But you place that capacity with me with a chart. And you see now why I've developed certain teachings, like Uranus, trauma, and healing. Certain perspectives on the outer planets and the way they interact with the personal planets to represent symbolically emergent processes from the deep unconscious coming through clients. Because I've based my entire astrological approach on the years of the psychotherapeutic training when I was doing the really just massively consistent deep work with people. And the fusion of the astrological light switch with the intuitional light switch that started to turn on within me just from being a therapist, plus the capacity to work in the dark, which is a genius point of therapy too. It looks like it's just a disadvantage, but it's not. To be able to work in the dark is a fantastic advantage as well as a disadvantage. When you combine all of them, the light switch of the chart, the light switch of one's intuition and inner knowing, and the capacity to work in the dark on the emergent edge of your experience and their experience, naked in the moment, can be incredibly empowering. You can have situations where a person that's been in years of quality analysis can be 35 minutes into a reading and having breakthroughs that the last 5 years of analysis didn't produce. It's just remarkable. In those moments where I am witness to that, and it feels like I'm witness to it, I'm involved because I'm there sharing with them. I'm part of it, but also a part of me watches it and is witness to it. And it just feels like a privilege. It feels like a explosion of meaning that I'm just privileged to be a part of.
Right. I mean, I imagine the capacity to, you know, quote unquote, work in the dark like that is sort of like working on a muscle that most people don't use very much. But therapists do it to such an extent that it becomes like something they're really good at and strong at. But when combined with astrology, it becomes even more powerful.
Yes. And if occasionally some astrologers who didn't want to train as therapists just did some push-ups in the dark to work on that muscle, they would find even with just minimal training in that area, it would add absolutely loads to what they've already developed through their astrological approach.
Sure. All right. So quickly, I was wondering if maybe I'd written down like a list to go back to a topic from earlier, maybe, and hopefully not to repeat things, but I'd written down a list of the different defense systems that you actually mentioned, because this is one of the more interesting chapters, because most astrologers won't be familiar with these things. They might have like a passing familiarity with one or two, but I was wondering if I could just like mention one and have you just define it really quickly in like a sentence or two, like what it is, just in order to sort of give a preview of the different concepts that you're addressing in the book. So what could you just define very briefly what reactive formation is?
Reaction formation is when, well, it has some complexities to it. So let me say this. I'd happily come back sometime and just talk about this subject because it's sufficiently complex. Not reaction formation, just defensive structures, yes, and how to move through them. The simplest way to understand reaction formation is to understand an example. An example of a certain type of it, admittedly. But I'm about to do a reading. Lady sits down, smiling. We're just chatting. I'm setting up my computer because we both met on the stairs coming up at the NORAC conference in Seattle up in the elevator, and she's a few minutes early and I haven't turned the computer on. So we're just making some small talk. I say, are you enjoying the conference or something, as I set the computer up and get her chart up? Yes, so many people. Oh, big grin on her face. I'm smiling so much. She looks up at me. My face hurts. And I go, oh, that's interesting. And she goes, yes, I think I always smile a lot when I'm nervous. Reaction formation is a kind of defensive strategy where you take something unpleasant like anxiety, social anxiety, and you turn it into sort of pleasing behavior. You form a reaction against it that you think you can get away with, if you like, that can deflect from it. So for her, constantly smiling was a way of displacing the anxiety she felt. Now, the advantage here of being aware of that to some extent, and you don't have to know the terms or read huge analytical books to recognize that when someone's smiling to the extent their face hurts, and then they fess up to you that they do that when they're nervous, that they're nervous. They're nervous in the whole conference. They're nervous in their life. And they're nervous because of the reading. And so I start the reading with a discussion of what she might be nervous about. And the reading is immediately into her authentic experience, nervousness. We don't waste half the reading on her smiling.
Sure.
And that counterbalances the reaction formation defense.
Yeah, I think that's amazingly important in order to be able to identify those things and have some strategies for coping with them and addressing them in order to have more constructive and useful and productive consultations. We don't have to spend the rest of this, but maybe just a few more for the sake of...
Of course, please, yeah.
Okay. So, one that people mostly are familiar with, but projection.
Well, yes, and it's much more complex, and it leads naturally to one of the others too, transference. But projection is essentially the capacity we all have to take unwanted or disowned part of our own experience and either find them in other people or in states of a complex extension of projection called projective identification, almost recreate them in other people. So I don't know. I'm an angry person. I'm inwardly critical and I get angry. And then I find, and I disown the anger. And all day long, I just meet angry people. All day long, people cut me up in traffic and scream at me. That's a form of projection. It just seems like you've met a bunch of schmucks. And actually, occasionally, you can just meet some horrible people in this world. You know, we can't just be naive here. But the tendency of projection, let's say I'm inwardly critical. I inwardly have this intense part of myself that's always lacerating this other part, like an intense internal critic going, Mark, this podcast with Chris Brennan is not going well enough. You're not coming across in the right way. You're not serving Chris's needs by asking you these nice questions. Blah, 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 blah. Some parental teacher dialogue, and it's lacerating the other part of me. And then someone comes into the room, or Chris asks me a certain question. I can't help it. Blurts out some critical thing about Chris. Some critical thing about the person that walks in the room. I criticize people around me because I'm projecting an unresolved state where I criticize myself within my own awareness outward.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah.
How does that relate to the other one, which is transference?
Transference is the explicit and specific projections that are related to early infantile experience. So it's the type of projections that were constellated by your parents and primary caregivers that would have appeared to you in your urgency of need as like gods. In the mammalian experience where we have these extended gestations and then these long periods where we're vulnerable afterwards, not like a foal of a deer that's born and can walk by the end of the evening, or a little baby crocodile emerges from the egg and can swim straight away. The baby crocodile's big risk is that daddy crocodile might eat it. You know, in the human realm, you're vulnerable for years, months, years of your life, completely dependent. And in that dependency, certain huge projected needs emerge, huge transferential needs to have parts of your own identity mirrored back to you. To have a parental figure that's stable enough to take your projective energy and through their gaze, through their mirroring of you, through their response to you, give that projected energy back to you in a way that's creative, that makes you feel, wow, I'm part of something, I'm part of a relationship. And certain projective dynamics and certain transferential dynamics are arguably the crucial defenses, the crucial issues that are going on that ruin many people's adult relationships, including their relationships with their astrologer or their therapist, but perhaps most painfully, their relationships with their husbands or wives or boyfriends or girlfriends.
Sure. Okay. One more counter-transference.
This is the response evoked in the practitioner by the power of transferential energy. So when a client goes into deep transferential energy, when they are, if you like, projecting very early childhood material that is pre-verbal, that is extremely intensely energized. And this can be like a feeling. I was in a room once with a client, and it's as if the client has become a squid that has just inked the whole room with blackness.
Mm.
It's just a childhood trauma state just came through. And imagine like it's like drowning in it. It's like palpable in the space. It's like hard to keep your eyes open, your head up. It's so overpowering. Counter-transference is when the power of the transference evokes unconscious, problematic responses within the therapist or astrologer.
Okay. So things coming from the astrologer or the counselor themselves.
Let me give an example. A young lady that came to work with me who's had a bullying and tyrannical stepfather. The original father had been alcoholic, and this man had come into her mother's life, and he was extremely critical and bullying of her. She used to be sick or feel sick hours before coming to meet me, had to wrestle to even speak to me, found me an intensely scary figure. And we worked for months with this extraordinarily creatively, played games. I swapped chairs with her so she could sit in the therapist chair, but she couldn't handle that. We threw a laptop cleaner, a little playful frog, around at each other, playing spelling games, childhood games. I was trying to break up the role because she couldn't handle me as the authority figure. And we made these incredible breakthroughs. And one day she was just talking in this whole other way. She was really broken through it. And then what often happens is when people have very powerful patterns and they break through them initially, they get a kickback from their unconscious. They break through, but it's almost like then the elastic band that's attached to all the past issue just somehow catches up with them and slaps them back down. So she was really breaking through, and then she just shut down out of nowhere. Just total powerful shutdown, like someone had cast a spell called silence on the room. Silence and shutdown. And this overwhelmingly negative, oppressive energy came into the room almost instantaneously. And all this work that had come to this breakthrough moment felt like it was threatened. And for a split second, I felt like shaking her or shouting at her and going, for God's sake, stay with it. Continue the breakthrough. You can do it. But it was a real, like, shouty, shaker kind of energy. And it just flashed through me for a moment, and I just completely let it go. I just didn't buy into it at all. I just completely let it go, and I just sat there in the silence until about 10 or 15 minutes later of silence, she started speaking to me quietly again, recognizing that something had shifted between us. And what I let go of was the way the power of her transferential shutdown evoked in me, because of a sincere desire to help her and for her to transform, the potential to fall unconsciously into the role of the bullying stepfather, where I'd be shaking her or going, come on, you can do it. She would have experienced that as aggressive. It would have constellated. So what countertransference does is it evokes in something genuine in the therapist or astrologer at times. In this case, you know, the lot of energy I'd put into helping her make this breakthrough, and then the shock and surprise of it shutting down again. But countertransference, it's like it's a transferential energy in her that tries to elicit a response from me that fits her known past. So it can just confuse the practitioner, and it can endanger them where they almost feel feelings that weren't there before. And yet they must have some root in their personal experience. So you see here, the root in my personal experience was the assertion and will that had gone into the process, if you like, that wanted it to work out for her. And that could have been unconsciously co-opted into this bullying, slightly pushy kind of stance, which reenacted that figure. And this kind of thing can happen even in a one-off reading. This kind of energy can be constellated. If you touch something deep in a client, it doesn't matter that you've only known them for 20 minutes. If you start discussing their Venus-Saturn aspect and something comes up about that, a lot of astrologers will just tune it out because they don't want to deal with that level of depth. And that, you know, I can understand that they don't, but it does let that person down in a way. It fails to recognize what's going on, that these transferential and counter-transferential dynamics can come out of nowhere in a split second if there is sufficient depth. It's not just to do. There's an old therapeutic idea that it just comes from years and years of being with the same therapist. There is a kind of transference that comes out like that because the therapist has become familiar to you, like a parent or a friend or just like a piece of furniture in your life, and you feel comfortable enough to express certain things. But there's another kind of transference that just comes out instantaneously just because it's in you. And that could come out hypothetically, even in an intense way, in an astrology reading, and I'm sure it has done multiple times.
Sure. So these are just a handful of like this whole series of different issues that you deal with in a specific chapter of the book. And you go into in a lot of depth. So other ones are congruence, parallel process, vicarious trauma, idealizing transference, mirror transference, and a number of others. So yeah, I think that's a really useful chapter in the book, especially for people that don't have any background in counseling or therapy, because these are issues that do come up in just about any type of consultation that an astrologer could possibly do.
Yes.
So the rest of the book, though, you deal with the planets for a large chunk of the book, first starting with Saturn and sort of drawing it as the boundary line between the traditional or the visible planets and then the rest of the outer planets that you refer to as transpersonal. And then you have basically a chapter dealing with the outer planets in other ways from that point forward. What was the point of that part of the book, or what can people sort of expect in terms of your treatments of the planets there?
Well, I mean, the insight in a way was to do with the Saturn cycle as well, linked to the formation of the personality developmentally. So it was a way of allying a key part of depth psychology insight, depth psychological insight, particularly of the analytical traditions and the psychodynamic traditions, which is that there is, you know, a developmental model to the formation of the person. Mm-hmm. And that the Saturn cycle corresponded really rather nicely with it, especially when you considered the way the Uranus cycle intersected with it.
Sure.
So that, and then I worked from a Harvard study called Seasons of a Man's Life. It was primarily a study of men, but it did show almost to stunning degrees of accuracy direct correlation with the archetypal Saturn and Uranus transits, you know, 28 to 30, early 40s. And these were incredibly statistically significant in this study to this section, to the fact that the man wrote up this research in a way that it looked like he was an astrologer. You know, he would just go like, you know, the 28 to 30 phase or whatever, because right. Statistically it was just shown. So it's incredible validation of the archetypal nature of the transits of these figures, and really helped me feel confident about placing Saturn as the boundary of the personal self and its formation. And that really, it's really what you could call the Cancer Capricorn axis. It's really the Saturn and the moon to me, and Saturn in phases, you know, like Saturn square, Saturn opposition.
Okay.
Crucial to the formation of the ego and the personality. And then the outer planets are really looking at deeper unconscious processes or parts of the non-linear energetic dimension of the psyche. So clearly, you know, some people don't recognize that there is that dimension. But as a psychosynthesis therapist, I explicitly do, that you have a non-linear energy field in which parts of your capacities, including, you know, traumas or struggles, but also beauty, power, joy, vision, intuition, strength, compassion, lovingness, are held in these like higher forms, almost like platonic forms, you could say, you know, of purer essential qualities, from which, for me, your authentic self is actually built from these essential qualities. You know, there is essential strength, there is essential lovingness, and then there are the kind of refracted forms that strength or lovingness can exist in the world that are not the same thing. You know, you can be with the person you love and be clearly in a slightly critical, slightly bummed out mood, and you still kind of love that person, but you're not embodying the essence of love in that moment. Just like you might have occasionally really genuinely feel strong, and other days you might kind of fake it till you make it, as they say, which is clearly a non-essential state. It is you just trying to live up to the memory of when you did feel really good like that. And what we can say is that this energetic dimension of psyche or the being or the self is really fundamental to profound transformation. And you can look at the way that the outer planets intersect with the personal planets as representative of the way aspects of the transpersonal self connect with one's personal experience.
One of the things I liked that you talked about a little bit and did in there was there's different astrologers seem to have different associations or schemes for like correlating the inner planets with the outer planets. And I think you adopted one that Rudyar outlined that I haven't looked at in a while, but I actually really like it as I was rereading it in your book, where you said that Mercury, that Uranus is a higher octave of Mercury.
Yes.
Neptune is a higher octave of Venus, and Pluto is a higher octave of Mars.
Yes.
I actually really liked those associations compared to some of the other models that I've heard over the course of the past decade or so.
Thank you. And it's a good spot. I mean, that's direct from certain writings in Rudyard, and he is radical about it. You know, that a higher octave is is more than just the same thing stepped up. It's radically transformative to the extent that aspects of the personal self might struggle with the higher octave unless there's a transformation. It's a very interesting model, and it really leads to some interesting reflections on the chart in a larger way. And there's actually a way that I might do in future work of relating that back to certain issues like projection and transference, actually, which I didn't actually do at the book. The book was so rich at that point that certain things were coming off the book that led to a succession of pre-conference day workshops at Norwalk, for example, or certain webinars I was teaching, because the material was becoming so rich that there was just all this stuff flowering off it, and not all of that went into the book. But thank you for that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it just comes directly from Rudyard. I mean, to be honest, Chris, increasingly, even though I studied with Green after doing Till's Masters in Counseling program in astrology.
Jeffrey Wolf Green.
Exactly.
Not Liz Green.
Not Liz Green. Pretty radically different, even though I massively respect Jung and I respect her power and perspicacity as a Jungian analyst.
Sure.
I still find that psychological vision of astrology limited, although still very valuable. It's not a part of astrology I'd like to see disappear, because it leads a lot of people into a deeper relationship with psychotherapy and its gifts. But I increasingly see where I'm coming from in Rudyard. I mean, just to a level of explicitness that when I was reading a pamphlet of his recently called From Humanistic to Transpersonal Astrology, there were some sections of it I thought, wow, I could have just written that like last week or something. And B, at the end, he's discussing this philosopher astrologer of the future who's open to the spiritual mystery but is therapeutically trained. And I just thought, wow, it's just like, I must just be on this weird track with the guy. And it's kind of funny because in this book, it has this whole introduction about how Mark Jones of, you know, London,
right,
taught Rudyard astrology. And then I'm reading Rudyard on humanistic to transpersonal astrology, and I'm reading it, I'm thinking, wow, I am just trying to embody what you're writing here. And I did all of it without having written what you'd, you know, without having read what you'd written here. It made me smile. And I just couldn't agree with the best of Rudyard more right now. I just think the man at his best is brilliant. At his worst, it's turgid theosophical regurgitation. And I've read whole Rudyard books, which I didn't find anything of value in. But if you pick the right books, and this From Humanistic Astrology to Transpersonal Astrology is just wonderful. I mean, it's just visionary. And he's clear about it. He's clear about the problems of astrology. And there's a section, if I'd not left the book in the other room, I'd read it to you. But it's something like, having now received so many letters from people who've had astrology readings complaining about what was said to them and how hurtful or damaging it was, I now realize that we must look to the psychological maturation of the practitioners of astrology. It's like an explicit thing. I read this after writing that book, you know, and that really was an element of my intention. You know, why do we ignore the insights of depth psychology? And to realize that the insights of depth psychology are a different thing from psychological astrology. It's not an invitation to drop your method. It's not like I'm saying, don't do traditional Hellenistic astrology, Chris Brennan. Come and do psychological astrology like Mark Jones does. No. Just only depth psychology existed, and you can do the thing that you're really into. You can just use some of what depth psychology came up with to make that thing more effective to the people that come to you for guidance from it. And that just,
right,
that's just so simple. It's so elegant, you know?
Right. Because what you're referring to and what you're addressing largely in the book is what, you know, like doctors refer to as a person's bedside manner in some sense, which
is,
you know, how do you talk to clients in the process of doing whatever it is that you do, and what sort of things are you aware of or take into account, and what is your general, almost in some sense, like ethical guideline for dealing with clients and how we respond to certain situations. And that's something that's universal in terms of its applicability to different types of astrology, whether you're doing Indian astrology or Hellenistic or evolutionary or what have you. But it's also something that, as you pointed out in the book, still surprisingly isn't very well defined in contemporary astrology, because I think one of the things you're alluding to is that so much of the psychological movement has almost been more about developing a technical psychological astrology as like a technique or as a school of astrology, rather than creating something that's more broadly applicable to different schools, that's just taking the best pieces from depth psychology and counseling and therapy and making them usable or applicable to astrologers.
Hey, fair play, my friend. You read the book and you really got some of, you're just saying why I wrote it, basically, in a nutshell. And to underline the importance of one of the things you said, bedside manner, you know, studies as to bedside manner and recovery clearly show a relationship. Studies as to the importance of the placebo effect can be, much of the effectiveness of antidepressant drugs, for example, can be put down to the placebo effect. People then take that as a reductionistic statement, and maybe it is about antidepressant drugs, but it's clearly a statement about psychology, about how important some sense of rapport or positive psychology or trust in the person you're with or the doctor by your side. And when it comes to therapeutic efficacy, studies of therapeutic efficacy almost always show that the quality and nature of the relationship is more important than the model of therapy being used. So the power of relationship in that sense, and the trust and the bedside manner, actually holds some of the healing and reparative power of the form. So it just seems to me, you know, obvious and just helpful on a massive level to focus on that explicitly at some point, you know.
Definitely. I mean, if you think your astrology is strong, like, it could be stronger by focusing on these things. Even if you're technically proficient, you may not be proficient in this other way, or at least perhaps you could excel even more.
Exactly. And get your message across that you clearly care about. You know, why have you done these hundreds of hours of reading and research and study to develop this vision of the meaning of astrology, only to have it fall on, you know, ears that through complex defense patterns since early childhood and through their insecurity and anxiety in the situation may have shut down slightly right from the beginning. I mean, simple practical things like recording the reading and things like that do help the client in that regard. But imagine if, alongside what you're saying and its technical clarity, is this empathic resonance that the client can really feel and really feel good about, and you then feel good about, positively reinforces the experience for the astrologer too. Because some astrologers who are really excellent practitioners struggle to do readings and don't always enjoy them because they feel it's such a strain to try and communicate their vision to this unknown person. Well, all of these rapport kind of building techniques, they help alleviate that. You know, they make it feel like we're all part of the human tribe, you know, the human family working towards something, you know, at least at its best.
Sure. Well, I definitely really appreciated the book. And I think other people that might be maybe reticent about it or not sure if it's useful for them, like traditional astrologers, for example, I'd definitely recommend it, because I think a lot of traditional astrologers are having to, you know, when we're translating these second century texts or texts from the medieval period or even from the Renaissance, like William Lilly or something, you know, Lilly doesn't have a chapter on, you know, dealing with transference and counter transference, surprisingly. So
he would have been ahead of his time.
Right. Yeah, I think, like, I can imagine some translator trying to understand why they can't translate this one Greek term, and it's because it's, yeah. Anyway, so there's things like that, I think, that are very applicable to even traditional astrologers or whatever school of astrology you're from, because like I said earlier, since these older forms of astrology are just being applied in a modern context for the first time, there's a lot of things that traditional astrologers are having to learn and put together from scratch in terms of the ethical, you know, what should be said and what shouldn't be said in a consultation, and how to do certain things ethically within the context of the early 21st century, and what's appropriate versus not appropriate. So I would definitely recommend this book to not just modern astrologers, but essentially anybody who does consultations with clients and who reads charts for people, no matter what chart, if that's a natal chart or a horary chart or even an electional chart, you'll find something of value in this book. And I guess you're going to, this isn't the end of this process, but this is actually the start of a process for you, because you're going to be developing a course on this, right?
Yes. I mean, 12-lesson audio download with accompanying essays, 90-minute to 2 hours audio of each lesson with detailed essays breaking down psychological thought from the 20th century alongside, you know, research into the origins of astrology and perceptions of astrology in particular, not the historical origins of astrology, but the way we see meaning through astrology. And then practical lessons in, you know, projection dynamics, transference, counter-transference. There's a lesson on, you know, maturation and self-development and sections on the true versus, as it were, false or adaptive self. And it ends, towards the end, there's, further practice issues of supervision, an ethical statement for astrologers that I'm developing with a professional colleague who's involved with the British Association of Counselors and Psychotherapists on their ethical board. Well, he's in a sort of esoteric influence in that organization anyway. Contemplating a statement of, you know, not something that you sign and feel heavy about, but, you know, a set of guidelines, if you like, for ethical consideration for all astrologers, yes, and how to contextualize the fragility and yet importance of the client's need that seeks you out and comes for this relatively high investment process, you know, paying reasonable amounts of money and sharing probably parts of their identity that they don't share with that many people and their hopes and aspirations and dreams, you know, where they'll live or whether they'll have success in life or what their psychological or spiritual issues of meaning are or even just, you know, when to do something important in their life. It's all to do with their life, how important it is to them. And clearly, that's the most important thing to many people. I have to say I really appreciate, you know, the time you've taken to read this book. And clearly, from my point of view at least, you've kind of got it. Because I wrote this book, hand on heart. Now, I just noticed I just put my hand on my heart. You can't see me, but I just done it and I observe myself doing it. That I wrote this book as a non-denominational statement. You know, I wrote the Counseling Skills for Astrologers course even more so. I mean, I barely mention astrology in the Counseling Skills for Astrologers course. It's all so really genuinely a traditional astrologer could look into it because it's really just about how to communicate a message to clients. But the book, you know, I can't help but refer to some astrology. I guess it's technically an astrology book, but it's minimal, isn't it, at points? It's really about, you know, what's going on when we meet someone in that space.
And I think even the astrology that you deal with, especially in terms of the planetary cycles, like the different stages in the Saturn cycle, or even the different stages in certain outer planet cycles, are still relevant and applicable and not going to be hugely controversial to most astrologers, regardless of what their system is.
And that's, you know, that was a real intention here. I'm sure I'll write some radical astrological statements at points. I certainly made them in person about my own kind of field and other fields. It's not like I don't have a relationship to that community, but this just seemed to transcend it on a heartfelt level. See, from my point of view, what emerged as a therapist was the awareness of years of being a therapist and working with people for maybe, you know, 1,100 hours, just one person, all the way to like 500 hours with one person, all the way to 40 hours with one person, or 1 hour with one person, just over their chart. So I've done, you know, over 1,000 hours with one person, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of just one-off readings. And the thing that dawned on me from all these scales of experience, I mean, imagine having all those scales of experience. Imagine having, you know, like the 8 or 10 people I've worked with for over 200 hours or something, or over 100 hours, and, you know, scaling that back then to what could go on in 1 hour. And in all of that, it was just what emerged for me more and more was the client's legitimate need to be acknowledged in the primacy of their being, to be cared about, that their life matters to someone for this in short but intense and valuable piece of time. And the healing involved in that, just that you care about them for that time. That's a huge chunk of it, regardless of what your astrological method is or what you're sharing with them, this information, this, you know, conceptual data that you've researched, that you're sharing with them via your words. Another huge part of what's going on is just the fact that you care about their life and are engaged with them on that level that really matters. That is a huge part of the value of the experience for people. And
definitely,
yeah, we can just pay more attention to that and therefore make more and more people feel more fulfilled and more supported in their life. And then the vision of that just spreading out into the world on some level. My hope that this is an emergent paradigm for the profession, really, to just pay more attention to that simple dynamic. Not Mark Jones's work, not even Mark Jones's book on that approach, just that approach itself, just caring about the being of the person in front of you, perhaps even more than your own astrological knowledge or practice. You know, that just, you know, that the process becomes really translating all these years of study and expertise that you have to meet the emergent need of this, you know, wonderfully complex person who's traveled maybe a long way to a conference to see you or contacted you on Skype from the other end of the country or the other end of the world. And the healing power that could come from seeing this really radical but simple truth, that the client's being and their emergent life potential is more important than your, you know, astrological ego, your ability, you know, your preparation, your intellectual clarity or not, that their life matters more than your how you practice astrology. All right, strive for excellence in your work, fine. But just surrender that to this person that's come to see you for something. Make creative effort to translate it to what's emerging in them.
I think that's basically, that would be, you know, you hear about like doctors having the primary sort of like ethical directive of, you know, do no harm or something like that. But I think what you're saying would make an excellent like rule number one on the list of like things as a counseling astrologer, as an astrologer in general, about what your primary directive is in some sense.
Yes.
I think that's an excellent vision.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I think that sort of is a good place to conclude our discussion. Other than the counseling skills program, what else are you working on or what do you have coming up?
So I'm doing the second part of a webinar on Jupiter, Visions of Meaning. The first part was done last weekend, but it's still available from the Astrology University. And it really explores perspectives on astrology, the way we can contextualize what astrology means to us, hermetic perspectives on astrology all the way through to modern perspectives, Rudyard's work. But it also then looks at even how we learn astrology, how we practice it, and how a vision of meaning is central to that and what we offer people. And then it goes into specific chart examples towards the end, which will be picked up primarily in the second part, detailed analysis of the Jupiter placement within multiple clients and, you know, famous people's charts. So I looked at Richard Feynman, the theoretical physicist, for example, and Viktor Frankl, the author of Man's Search for Meaning, who survived the concentration camps, and looked at Jupiter placements and the way it related to their vision of meaning or faith or what brought them through their life experience. So that's an interesting subject. And then in September, I'm in Florence after the Astrological Association conference here in England. I'm going to Florence to the archive of Roberto Saggioli again for 4 days to spend in the archive researching any last pieces of information I can gain from this incredibly fruitful interface of essentially Freud, Jung, Dana Rudyard, and Roberto Saggioli and his astrological and psychological writings. So hopefully there'll be some more discoveries.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing what results from that and seeing what your follow-up books are in the future. All right. Well, everyone can check out and order a copy of the book on your website, which is plutoschool.com, or I think you can find it on Amazon and other fine booksellers worldwide. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, and I'll have to have you on again next time with whatever your next book is. But I think this one's going to be big, so I hope listeners check it out and then leave us a comment and let us know what you think. All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Mark.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the clarity of your questions and the sincerity and integrity with which you approached what I wrote. And I really feel actually the points you truly captured what my intention was and you really grasped it. So I'm really grateful for that. Thanks.
Great. Well, I'm glad that we made this connection. And I'm glad that I was able to, so I could read this book because I think it's important. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show. And I've been dying to ever since we talked about it earlier this year that you're getting close to finishing it. So, all right. Well, that's it for this show. So thanks everyone for listening and we'll see you next time.